The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Today I want to talk about self-actualization. And so in order to do that, I have selected a piece from the writings of Rav Kook, which I feel helps us understand what the Torah means to us in a self-actualization level. This piece that we're handing out is from a book called The Lights of Holiness. And most of Rabbi Kook's books are in fact in some way titled light. There's the light of holiness. There's the light of prayer. There's a book called Lights. And it's all about light. And, you know, the Sfat Emet once said there are some people who live in the light, and then there are some people who are the light. And when you are the light, you enable others to see. So his books are really lights. They're not just information. When you learn the teachings of Rav Kook, you discover the light of Torah, and the world looks very different in this light. So this particular piece, which is from the third volume of his book or a set called The Lights of Holiness, or Orot HaKodesh, this particular piece is referred to as Bakashat Ha'ani Ha'atzmi, the request or the search for the essential self, right? The Ani Ha'atzmi, the very essential self. Now, without even going further, we begin to ask ourselves, well, if there is something called the search for the essential self, then there must be a non-essential self. Okay? And so what is the non-essential self in contrast to the essential self? So we read, "And I am among the exiles, in the midst of the exiles." Yesterday we examined a piece from Aryeh Kaplan, and he brought this verse down. And this is a very famous verse because the Zohar, as Aryeh Kaplan brought down yesterday, tells us that when Yechezkel says, "I'm in the exiles," it's not just Yechezkel is in the exile, but the I is in the exiles. Okay? The ultimate I is in the exile. Not just the personality, the character, Yechezkel. Now we know he's in the exile. But when it says, "I am among the exiles," it's not Yechezkel, the individual speaking, but it's, so to speak, the great I, Hashem, the ultimate I, speaking through Yechezkel, saying, "I am in the exile." What is this referring to? This is referring to the notion of the exile of the Shekhinah. In Judaism, there's an idea that the divine, or to be more specific, the divine presence, can be an exile. So that's what it says over here. Rav Kook is going to work on this piece. "And I am among the exiles. The inner essential I of each person and of the community is truly revealed not only according to its holiness and purity, its supreme might, concerned in the pure illumination of sublime brightness burning within it." Now first you have to understand something about Rav Kook's style. Rav Kook had a hard time expressing himself in words. As I think I shared with you a little while back, Rav Kook talks about speech as a spiritually painful experience. To try and cram into little words, the depth of my heart, the experience of my soul, is painful. Okay? And for Rav Kook to write was painful. To say what he had to say was painful. In fact, I don't know if it's true, but I heard that when Rav Kook was on his deathbed, he died relatively young. He died when he was 70, you know? And relative to others that could have, I mean, you could go to 80, 90, 100. Rav Kook said that he thinks he's dying young because he revealed too many secrets. So Rav Kook really went out on a limb for the Jewish people. He felt he was going out on a limb. He felt that he had to reveal some of the secrets of the Jewish people to the public. And it was very hard for him because what he knew was so deep, words were difficult for him. On the other hand, it's quite known that Rav Kook's writing style was very spontaneous in that apparently he was under the influence of Ruach HaKodesh, divine spirit, and therefore some of the original manuscripts of Rav Kook are found that he goes off the page. A number of his manuscripts he writes off the page onto the table. He was not aware of the borders of his page. Okay? He was in such a state of mind and inspiration that it came down. So, you'll have to forgive his grammar, in short. Okay? Because he has very long sentences and he does not want to confine himself to grammatical structures. Right? Because it's an outpour of the depth of who he is. And so, with that long introduction to this long sentence, let's try and understand the sentence. The sentence goes like this. What Rav Kook is telling us this. There's an inner essential I. And that I is not only individual. That I is the community also. Everybody in this room feels they've got their own I. Their own self. But the truth is we share an I. There's a certain national self also. And this individual self, as well as this national self, is not always revealed according to its purity and its holiness and its illumination and its sublime brightness. Yes, the self, a spark of the divine, is brilliant, illuminating, but it's not always revealed that way. What could interfere with the self really shining forth, right? Really shining forth. We have sinned, as our fathers have. The sin of Adam, the first man. Rav Kook is giving us such a deep understanding of the meaning of sin in Judaism. Now, you know, I always have a problem teaching Torah in English. Because there's no such thing as sin in Judaism, right? The word S-I-N is an English word, right? And it's English, a translation of a Hebrew word with the hope that it approximates the Hebrew word. But who says it approximates the Hebrew word? You follow? So translation is always a problem, right? We believe in God. We don't believe in God. We believe in Hashem. Ah, but we have the word God, so we use it. But then again, it's used in the Christian world. So we begin to associate words with the Christian meaning of these words. And very often, unfortunately, much too much, we're so influenced by the Christian way of seeing things that we're really understanding Judaism in a Christian garb. And that's the greatest problem of Judaism today. And educating Jews about Judaism is they understand it with the Western mind based on a very Christian-oriented society. So when you see the word sin, I start thinking of a guy on the street with a drum working for the Salvation Army telling everybody, return you sinners, return you sinners. He's got a little thing in front of him. When I hear the word sin, that's what comes to my heart. And therefore I don't have a good association with it. In Judaism, the word chet literally means to be off. To be off. I understood this one Shabbat when Chana and I were walking, taking our Shabbat stroll, and all of a sudden I heard thousands of people screaming, Chet! 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 I thought, oh my gosh, what is this? Some kind of religious revival going on? Thousands of people screaming, Chet! Well, it turned out to be the soccer field just behind, or just in front of actually the King David Hotel. And soccer is a special thing to do on Shabbat in Israel. And one of the terminologies of when a guy kicks the ball and misses the goal is chet. And apparently the referee was saying that there was an in, or I don't know what, but you had thousands of people screaming on Shabbos, chet, chet. I said, oh my gosh, maybe Mashiach came, what is going on? Chet actually is a terminology in soccer, in you know, Israeli soccer, which means you missed the goal. You missed the goal. And so too, in Judaism, there are ways of living which are on the mark, and there are ways of living which are off the mark. You know, they say a cute little story that there was this fellow, and he was shooting arrows randomly in the air, right? And then he would walk up to where it would land, and he would draw a circle around it. So someone came up to him and says, "What are you doing?" He said, "What do you mean? I'm shooting arrows." He says, "Well, why don't you have a bullseye and shoot at a bullseye?" He says, "No, this way works better. You see, first I shoot in the air, and then I draw a circle around it, and I make the bullseye." Right? In other words, that's how many people live their lives. Right? They create the bullseye around where they end up. And that was their goal. Chet means I'm off the mark. I'm somehow off. And what does it really mean in a deeper way? When a person sins, what they're actually doing is causing a certain inner eclipse of their true self. They're just not, their self is not shining out. It's getting lost in their personality, it's getting lost in their character, it's getting lost in their scene, but their true presence is just not coming out. Not coming out. And therefore, for Judaism, chet would really mean a loss of self. I've lost myself. I've really lost myself. I don't know if you've ever had that experience where you lose yourself. And you, I don't know what got into me. I don't know what happened. I lost myself. It's possible to lose ourselves. But what does it mean to lose ourselves? Look, there are certain ways of life which are really on the mark. This is a way of life that is truly an expression of myself. And then there's ways of life that just, it's not me. It's just really not me. And you feel that, you know. Some people feel it in their clothing. They put on, this is just not me. This is just not me. And they feel that rather than this clothing really somehow enhancing them and bringing out their true who they are, it's like, you know, you can go to a color tester and they can tell you the right colors, which is really you, right? There is such a concept as the real you. But it's possible to live a lifestyle, to dress in a manner, so to speak, to take on a lifestyle which is really not you. I remember years ago, I went with my sister. She wanted to buy a dress, and there was this designer fellow in Toronto who had some like special sale going on. So she said, "Let's go with me. Come with me." I said, "Okay, fine." So we go into this place, and the guy, the designer, he's very bright. First of all, he not only designs the clothing, he also stands in the store and sells it, right? And his name is Jacques. And the truth is, his name is Jack Bernstein. But Jack Bernstein's not a designer. Jacques. Right? So Jacques, this Yiddish guy, right? He stands in the store and he's designing all stuff. And so my sister's looking and she's looking at the prices and they're just they're outrageous, you know? And then this woman walks in, an elderly woman, and she says, Oh, Jacques, I'm looking for something new today. He says, Oh, Mrs. Frankel, I've got just the thing for you. And so, you know, everybody in the store is waiting. You know, Jacques says, this is it, right? So he goes over to a rack. It seemed to me very random, but he goes over to the rack. He takes his hand. He pulls out this lime green fluorescent dress and he says, "This is you." Well, she looks at it and she goes, "Oh my God, no, it's not me," right? He says, no, I'm telling you, it's you. So she says, "Really, do you think so?" He says, I'm sure it's you. And everybody in the store is going, you know, but Jacques is really pushing. So she says, just try it on. She says, "Well, do you think so? I mean, I just couldn't. I mean, how could I walk out? Okay, I'll do it." So she walks into the dressing room. Everyone's waiting. This is going to be hysterical, right? This is going to be just pathetic, actually. And she walks out in this dress. And, of course, Jacques says, It's you. It was meant for you. I designed it for you. So she looks in the mirror. She goes, "Oh, no." And he kept going on and on. I could see her face changing and changing. Before you know it, she's so excited. She says, "You know, Jacques, I think you're right. It is me. It really is me." You know, everybody's story going. Anyways, Anyways, you just go to show how people can really lose themselves. The point is like this, that a person really can lose themselves. If they are living in a manner which is not truly expressive of who they are. Now this is the amazing claim of Judaism. The claim of Torah is, this is you. This is your environment. These are your lines. This is your garment. You know, this script was written for you. And this character is just you. And when you play that character, the essential you really comes forth. And people really feel it. And you're not a fake. People feel the authenticity in who you are. And so, Rav Kook is telling us that when a person does a chet, something which is not correct for a Jewish person in this world, a Jewish soul to be doing, then essentially it's really a loss of self. It's a loss of self. So there is this inner essential I, which is brilliant, which is just illuminating, but it's not always revealed. Why? Because sometimes we live our lives in a way that conceals the inner self. And it does not come through. And it does not come through. And that image of God that we were created in, you just don't see it. You know, of course Judaism claims that all people have been created in the image of God. But Judaism does not guarantee that that will become manifest. That's your choice. The potential to be this living expression of such holiness, that everyone has. But the choice to live in a way that will express that, that is really up to us. This is the deeper meaning of the word emunah. We talked about emunah before in a number of ways, but another way of understanding emunah, faith, is to realize the source of the word. The word emunah also comes from the word omanut. Omanut means to be an artist, to portray. Omanut is an artist. What is the ability of an artist? An artist has the ability to take something which is spiritual, abstract, and in a concrete manner express that with colors and lines and forms. That's what emunah is. A person who truly lives emunah is a person who portrays their inner self, this holiness, into the world. Right? And really, essentially, the question is, you know, there's a pasuk that says, "Kol mitzvotecha emunah." All your mitzvot are emunah. Now, that doesn't make sense. How could all your mitzvot be emunah? The answer is that all mitzvot are a way of portraying my true self, my inner self. That's what the Torah claims, right? That's what the Torah claims. We either have the choice to portray our inner self or to betray our inner self. And that's really the choice. And therefore, we have sinned as our fathers have, the sin of Adam, the first man, who was estranged from his essence. He forgot who he was. He forgot who he was. Who heeded the snake and lost himself could offer no clear answer to the question, where are you? This is the ultimate question. This is the question we are all being asked every single day, whether we hear that voice inside or not. The question is, where are you? After Adam sinned and ate of the tree of knowledge of good and bad, God said, where are you? Now, this is not hide and go seek, right? It's not ollie ollie oxen, but come on, man, where are you? You must be hiding somewhere. Certainly God knows where man is. So the question wasn't a geographical question to try and find his hiding place. The question was, where are you? You lost yourself. You lost yourself. This is a very frightening question. We have to ask ourselves, where am I? Where am I? Now I want you to understand the dynamics of what really happened in the Garden of Eden. In the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve are in the garden. There's the tree of knowledge of good and bad. And then there's the snake. Right? And the snake comes up to them and says, you know why God doesn't want you to eat of the tree? Because he knows that on the day that you will eat of that tree, you will be like gods. And the oral tradition says that God ate from this tree, so to speak. This is what the snake was intimating. That God ate of this tree. It gave him the wisdom to create worlds. You too would be creators. You too would be gods. And you too would be able to decide what is good, what is bad. You don't need God to tell you what is good, what is bad. You don't need God to tell you what's moral and immoral. You'll decide. It's the tree of knowledge of good and bad. And you will determine what is good. You will determine what is bad. Okay. What was the snake really saying? You know, the Zohar talks about the venom of the snake. That this snake injected, so to speak, a venom. What is this venom? It's Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara is slanderous talk. And the founder of slander, that sounds great, the founder of slander, is the snake. The snake spoke slanderously of God. What was the snake saying? The snake was putting into their head such a distorted picture of God. What was the picture of God he was putting in their head? There's God over there. There's you over here. God doesn't want you to eat of the tree because he doesn't want competition. Because if you eat of that tree, you will be like God. You will make your own decision and you won't need him. How can God keep you under his cosmic thumb? Right? How? Simple. By giving you mitzvot. By giving you commandments. Through these commandments, he will ensure his sovereignty over you and stifle your growth and undermine your desire to be God too. That's what the snake was saying. They should know this idea has been echoed throughout history philosophically, right? Because I don't know if you're familiar with what Nietzsche said. Nietzsche said there's two types of people in the world. There's strong people and there are weak people. Now, the strong people do what they want, when they want, how they want. They do what they want. They're strong. The weak people, they're weak, but they're smart. What did the weak people do? They came up with a plot called morality. And they came up, they invented morality in order to make the strong feel guilty that they're so strong. Brilliant plan, right? That's how the weak protected themselves. They made all those strong people feel guilty that they're so strong. And who are these weak people? The founders, the perpetrators of morality? The Jews. That's what Nietzsche said. And he then said the Christians continued the mission of the Jews. And therefore a person should know there's no God. It's all a plot. There's no such thing as morality. Might makes right. We will live in a world of the jungle. And you know, Hitler loved the teachings of Nietzsche. And Hitler proudly says in Mein Kampf, we are barbarians and we are proud of it. I have come to free the world from the shackles, the invention of the Jews. Basically, that's what he said, Mein Kampf. And so this goes, this is a very long history what the snake started. The snake put into the mind of man an image of a God over there, a man over here. He injected within us a sense of a dichotomy between the human and the divine. And once there's a dichotomy, there's competition, there's tension, and then the story is all about who's going to win. And who will overpower? But we know that that's crazy. Although we know that philosophically, I don't know if we know it in our hearts yet. Because is it possible that the self could be against me? Is it possible that the great self would be against the self? In other words, think of this. People think that the relationship between God and man is some kind of external relationship. I'm over here and God's over there in heaven. The relationship between man and God is an internal relationship. You meet God not in outer space. You meet God in inner space. That's where you meet God. And so we discussed yesterday, there's the me, myself, and I. There's the me, which is the character I play. There's the self, which is the soul, which is the actor, which is the experiencer. And then there's the source of the soul, the spark of the sense of I, which is the great I, the one who said at Sinai, I, God, am your God. I is one of the names of God. Right? I is one of the names of God. In fact, Rav Zushi of Arnapul, which is a great Hasidish Rebbe, he would never say I. How could I say I? He wouldn't say I. So if he came to the door, knocked on the door, someone said, who is it? He'd say, Zusha. So they say, Zusha's not home. No. Zusha. Zusha's not home. He would never say, I am Zusha. He could never say I, only God is I. God is the ultimate I. Who am I to say I? Right? And so the ultimate I, the Anochi Hashem Elokecha, the ultimate, the great self, the source of all consciousness, that is God. Can the man in my mind run away from my mind? Can the man in my mind hide? This was the ridiculous thing that man and woman did. After they sinned, they hid. How can you hide from me? Who do you think I am? You think I'm like you, some being in time and space over there? Right? Just as your character cannot hide from yourself cannot hide from the great self. But this warped thinking was injected by the snake. And now we live with this sense of a God over there, a me over here. There's some kind of dichotomy. There's kind of some kind of conflict. There's some kind of conflict of interest. Right? Is there a conflict of interest between yourself and your character? Of course not. So how can there be a conflict of interest between you as a spark of the divine and the divine? But it's only based on this paradigm. The snake gave Adam and Eve this paradigm which severs mankind from God. Okay? And that's why if they eat a tree of knowledge of good and bad, then they're going to die. Now, they didn't die, did they? Not physically, but spiritually they did. Because death is severing myself from the oneness. Severing myself from the source of all consciousness, God. Okay. Yeah, so I'll pull it together. You see, Adam and Eve didn't have a picture of God. They were so instinctively, intuitively plugged into God that they didn't even know they were plugged into God. You know? And therefore the snake had a very important role of stimulating consciousness through challenge, right? And we become conscious when we have problems. When we don't have problems, we're floating along. But when something stirs up the wind, all of a sudden we start to think, hey, wait a second. So the snake had a holy mission. His job was to present in front of Adam and Eve a paradigm which pictured God and man in a duel, in a competition, in conflict. Pictured a God over there and a man over here. And once that picture was presented to them, now they could say, well, I don't know, do I believe in that picture? Does that picture suit what I've known in my heart all along, but I never really questioned? And had they taken the time, they would have said, nah, that's a silly picture. You're a dumb snake. Get lost. You know, that's what would that be? That doesn't mean anything to me. But they didn't. They didn't. If they would have taken the time to really think about whether this picture that he's painting makes sense to their sense, to their natural sense, they wouldn't have done it. But nonetheless, his job will be complete whether they say yes or no, because his job is to generate consciousness. I said there was free choice, but there's also a plan, and it's a paradox. So from the free choice point of view, man could have chosen either way he wants. From the paradox, in terms of the way the plan's gone, I think I shared, maybe it was Tuesday night, I shared this midrash, that in the midrash, in the old tradition, at the end of the story, Adam turns to God and says, wait a second. Wait one second. Wait. The tree in the middle of the garden. You could have put it somewhere else. And then you send this snake in, starts telling me to eat it, eat it, eat it. Wait, this is a setup. You know? And he gave an analogy. It's like a husband walking into his house. He's got a divorce document in his back pocket. He says, hey, sweetheart, good evening. Could I have a drink? Could you pour me a drink? She says, sure, sweetheart, good to see you. She pours him a drink. He takes one gulp. He says, yuck! This is lukewarm. You are divorced. Takes out his pocket. She says, you had that in your back pocket all along. You set me up. This is the Midrash. You like that one, eh? Make sure you ask, what temperature would you like? I tell you, man, you can't trust them, you know? Anyways, so Adam turns to God and says, you set me up. You had divorce document in your back pocket, right? And the Midrash ends without an answer from God, right? Because that's the answer. It's beyond yes, it's beyond no. And so, it's yes and no. It's yes and no. We are on a consciousness journey. We are evolving. And in our lives, we are learning to come to know who we are and who is God. And that is one of the greatest questions that has to be resolved. Unfortunately, I don't see it being resolved enough in Jewish educational institutions. It's almost not even being addressed. But this is the greatest problem. If we come to Judaism with a Christian paradigm, we're not going to be happy with Judaism. And we're going to think this is Judaism, right? And so Adam and Eve, when they ate of the tree, what did they essentially do? They estranged themselves from their essence. How could you think there could be a conflict between yourself and the great self? Right? How could there be a conflict of interest? It's ridiculous. But the snake gave them such a paradigm of a God over there, man over here. So he heeded the snake and he lost himself, could not answer the question, where are you? Because he did not know his own mind, because he had lost his true I-ness by his sin of bowing down to an alien God. Right? An alien God. Who is the alien God? Essentially, it's himself. He makes himself into a God. Now, this is one of the most important ideas in Judaism, I think. That there's one illusion that we live, which is the most problematic illusion. And that illusion is that we in and of ourselves have meaning. That we are self-defined, self-sufficient, separate entities. And that's an illusion according to Judaism. Even though I look around the room and it seems to be confirmed by a bunch of separate entities, Judaism says we are all connected, we are all interdefined, and nobody is self-defined except God. God is the only reality which is self-defined. All other entities are defined by virtue of their relationship to each other and to the ultimate, to God. And therefore, but when we fall into what the Hasidic thought or Kabbalah talks about, klipot, we fall into a hard shell. What is the hard shell? The hard shell gives me this illusion that I am in this shell and I got to now save my skin. And the real David Aaron is in this body. Who says David Aaron's in this body? Who says your mind is in your body? Maybe your body's in your mind. Not that it's an illusion, right? But how do you know? I mean, we have a sense that we're in here. Where are you? In here? Somewhere back here? Where are you? And yet, instead of experiencing ourselves as mind, and that our bodies are really in our mind, we've now fallen to experience that our minds are in our bodies. And now that we feel our minds in our bodies, we begin to think we are our bodies. And therefore I see a bunch of bodies. And so, when Adam and Eve ate of the tree of knowledge of good and bad, what really was the problem? Some say that that tree had nothing to it at all. There was nothing special about that tree. It was just the tree that God said, don't eat. And that was the acid test. Right? Do you think there's some kind of conflict of interest? You think that God is holding out on you. And that's why God is saying don't eat. And so, the snake put it into his head and we still got it in our heads. Because somehow there's this conflict of interest. Now I want to share with you a piece from the Zohar. The Zohar says that when the Jewish people were at Sinai, for a moment, the venom of the snake left them. How? When they said, Naaseh v'nishma. When God says, do you want my Torah? The Jewish people said, we will do, then we will listen. I don't care what it is. I just want you to know I'll do it. Now tell me what it is. Right? Now how were they able to say that? See, because the old tradition said that actually God went to a lot of nations. And God says, do you want my Torah? And the nations said, well, what's in it? God said, well, thou shalt not have adulterous relations. Well, that's a bit of a problem for us. I mean, that's one of our favorite pastimes here. I mean, we couldn't do that. You know, no, it's not for us. All right? God went to another nation and said, would you like my Torah? And they said, well, what's in it? Thou shalt not steal. Quite frankly, I mean, that's the foundation of our economic system here. We really couldn't do that. Right? But when God comes to the Jewish people and says, do you want my Torah? They don't say what's in it. They say, Naaseh v'nishma, whatever's in it, we'll do it. Why? Because for that moment, they had the right paradigm. They understood God not as a being over there imposing his will on me, and this is some effort to subdue me, and I'll do it if it fits into my life, but rather it was a realization, how could I not do it? How could I not do what the source of all of consciousness wants me to do? Surely what's written this is all about how to be me. Obviously. What else would the great self be asking of me to do than to do that which is essentially me? But everybody else didn't understand that. The Jewish people understood it for a moment. Right? But then they blew it again also with the golden cap. But they had a moment. Listen, great moments are still important. Okay. And so, we continue over here. We say the word Israel. 1, 2. Israel sinned. It went whoring after strange gods, deserted its own essence. Israel neglected the good. But Rav Kook is about to show us that the essential theme, the consistent theme of sin, is betraying yourself. Not really being who you are. That's the greatest sin. And that's the greatest punishment. You know, people think punishment, you know, when you're a child, so you think of punishment, you know, your parents slap you on your hand because you did something wrong. But the Torah teaches on a deeper level, the truth is, the sin is its own punishment. Living this way is its own punishment. Like Rav Kook explains in another place, that ego, being conceited and haughty, is its own greatest punishment. So go ahead. You're only hurting yourself. Kook is telling us that the consistent theme of the Jewish people is they're afraid to be who they are. They're embarrassed to be who they are. They're looking for some kind of value by being like everybody else. We're not like everybody else. And that's just the way it is. And I have no reason to feel embarrassed about it. Be who you are. You know, I always find this very strange. You know, why be Jewish? I think the question is, well, are you Jewish? If you are Jewish, well, why not be Jewish? I mean, it's like asking, why be a redhead? But I am a redhead, so why not be a redhead? You know? The point is, what do you mean, why be Jewish? The question is, am I Jewish? My whole life, I thought I was Jewish. I don't know why. I just felt I'm a Jew. But I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know how to express it. You know? And so I remember when I was in high school, I felt I wanted to express it because that's who I am. I don't want to be who I am. I'm not embarrassed. So I wore a Jewish star. You know? Wore a little mezuzah, actually. Felt really good about that. You know? See? I'm Jewish. Then I was working. I was in high school. I got a job in this place called the Canadian National Exhibition. This is where all the high school students go to get jobs for the summer. So I got a job in a firing range. It was one of these games where you shoot things off of shelves, right? And, you know, I was embarrassed to be a Jew. I had my little Jewish star, you know, on my chest. You know, I had my T-shirt, with my Rolling Stone T-shirt, and my Jewish star just over top of that, you know. And this one guy comes up. He says, give me 5 shots. You know, this is the dumbest game. You shoot packages of cigarettes off a shelf. And if you get it off the shelf, you win the pack. I mean, meshuggah, you know? Absolutely meshuggah, you know? You pay basically the same amount as you would have paid if you bought it next door, but this is different. I won this. I remember one guy, he'd already put down like $10. He couldn't win a pack of cigarettes. While he's shooting, his friend comes by smoking a cigarette. He looks and he says, hey, where did you get that? He says, next door. He says, oh, man. Anyway. So this one guy says, give me 5. I give him 5 bullets. You know, these are cork bullets, you know, but, you know, with these air guns and shoot them. Guy's aiming up for one of these packages of cigarettes. Looks at me, says, a Jew! He shot me. Right? Hit me off the shelf and won me. I'm just joking. He shot me. I was in absolute shock. Right? Guy looks at me and shot me. That was one of those big existential crises, you know, like, oh, so David, are you proud to be a Jew? So David, tomorrow you're going to wear that mezuzah out? Right? And I thought a lot about it. And I said, well, you know, I wear it inside, outside, you know. It was really a shock. And then I started asking myself, so what does it mean to be a Jew? You know? It's easy to put a mezuzah on until anybody challenges you on it. But once you put it on, you say, hey, I want to be me. Right? Sounds like a great song, so why don't I live that way? That's the question. Israel isn't being itself. It's just not being itself. Why am I embarrassed? What am I ashamed about? And yet, this has been the consistent theme throughout the Tanakh. The Jews try to be like everybody else. The interesting thing is that precisely when we want to be like everybody else, that's when everybody else doesn't like us. And you wonder, that doesn't make any sense. You know? But it makes a lot of sense. Because nobody likes a fake. Nobody likes a fake. And when they feel it, you know? Kids are so sensitive to it. It's unbelievable. My kids can pick it up on people. They can pick it up on people that this person is genuine and this person is a fake. They just have this sense, you know? And kids talk about it all the time, about, she's such a fake. You know, how does a kid know this? Because children, in many ways, are just so natural who they are. You know? Children have a hard time faking. They're just basically who they are. Only when we grow up do we learn the art of being a fake. But being a fake is really essentially what Judaism calls a sin. It's the essential sin. You know, that's not who you are. Right? It's simply not who you are. And so, it deserted its essence. Israel neglected the good. What is the good? To be who you are. To be who you are. And that's not an easy thing, because not always do we know who we are. Or we know who we are, but we can't just find exactly the way of life that allows what kind of profession that's for a Jewish boy. You're not going into acting. So I remember when I got into high school, there was an option between theater arts and accounting. I for sure took theater arts. My parents said, no, I got such pressure from not only my parents, but my whole family. I mean, relatives, uncles, aunts are calling me up like, this is the greatest. My son is going to go into, you know, acting. He's really going to start his acting career, and, you know. And so I went through this great crisis, and I said, okay. And I gave up theater arts, and I went into accounting. And I actually thought for a number of years I'd be an accountant. Could you imagine what hell that would be, being an accountant? Right? But it's so easy to lose yourself. Right? So easy to lose yourself. And I could have done it. I could have become an accountant. Right? I'm sure I could have passed it, but I would have been miserable my whole life. Why? Because I would be living a lifestyle and doing a job that just isn't me. It's just not me. And so a person has to find that lifestyle that environment, that community, which really is who they are. And therefore, Torah is claiming that a Torah life is how a Jew expresses who they are. That's its claim. But not only that, the land sinned. The Torah has a midrashic piece that tells us that the land sinned. What was the land sin? Denied her selfhood. What did she do? Sapped her own strength. Pursuing aims and ends, did not devote all her hidden virtue to making the taste of the tree be as the taste of its fruit. Now let me tell you something. There is a midrash that says that God said to the earth, produce fruit trees. Which means trees that taste like fruit. That's what the land was supposed to produce. And that the original design was that the trees, you could take a bite out of its trunk, and it would taste as sweet as the fruit. It was a fruit tree. But if you look at the verse in Genesis, clearly it says, and the earth produced a tree of fruits. Rather than a fruit tree, a tree of fruits. Meaning now, the tree probably doesn't taste too good. Nobody has too much interest in eating the tree. And the fruit is sweet. So what is this midrash really talking about? Is it to be taken literally? You see, the tree is a symbol of the means. The fruit is the symbol of the goal. And really, the earth had the potential to produce a tree whereby the process was as sweet as the goal. But it didn't do that. Now, what is that talking? What's that really all about? It's really about us. You see, we need to appreciate that the process of life is as sweet as the goal. But we don't have that consciousness. We have this feeling like, oh, I'm doing this in order to get that. But so much of our life is the process. It's the process. It's like my wife once shared with me, she was holding Suriel, and she said, you know, I realize there are very few great moments in your life, but every moment could be a deep moment. Every moment could be a deep moment. And so people are waiting for that great moment. They feel they're building up to that great moment. And then, I did it. I got it. I achieved. The process itself should be as sweet as that goal. That's what it means to be who you are. You are a process. And when a person denies themselves and thinks that your true moment of fulfillment is some moment 5 years from now, 10 years from now, when I accomplish this, you're really not being who you are. You are life. You are now. You are here. And therefore, you've got to be here with that excitement of doing that. And therefore, that's the hint over here of the land sinning, that it didn't devote all her hidden virtues to making the taste of the tree as sweet as the taste of fruit. That's what we should do. We should make our efforts that this moment should be as sweet as those big moments in the future. Because there's no reason why this moment is any less sweet. If you're really being who you are, which is a process, which is a being who's alive, who's living. Now he brings in another idea. She cast her eyes outside of herself, taken up with fortunes and careers. You see, when a person thinks their ultimate happiness is with their fortunes and their careers, they're looking for happiness outside of themselves, rather than looking for happiness by being themselves. Do you follow the point? People look for happiness rather than being themselves in a career for themselves, something outside of themselves. But the greatest happiness is when you're really being yourself. The question is, who is my true self? And how can I truly be my true self? Right? But that's when we're really happy. That's when we're really happy. When we're doing something that's not who we are. Oh, is that painful? Is that ever painful? This is what they say about Esav. You know, Esav comes in, he just finished a rampage of raping and stealing and murdering, and he walks in and he says to his brother, I'm so tired. It's been a long day, bro. Raping and gee, you know, it's been a hard day at work out there killing. So he says, I'm tired. He says, pour that red stuff down my throat. Now, it's a little strange. He didn't say I'm hungry. Right? I'm tired. He's not hungry. He's tired. Asaph came in depressed. He said, I'm tired. Why is he tired? So Rashi brings down, he's spiritually tired. Because when a person does things like that, they feel exhausted. You know, there's different levels of feeling exhausted. You know, a person can feel exhausted because they moved all kinds of heavy furniture. They feel exhausted, they're physically exhausted. A person could be mentally exhausted because this week they had to move worlds by making decisions. They feel physically exhausted. But there's another kind of exhaustion which is just absolutely the most difficult. It's spiritual exhaustion. And spiritual exhaustion is when I'm doing something which is just not me. Maybe it was me. It's not me anymore. And it's not a hard job. It could be the easiest job in the world. But just to do something that's not me is so painful. So incredibly painful. And so, what Rav Kook is telling us over here is when a person looks for some career and thinks the career is going to make them happy, the career is not going to make me happy unless this career becomes, you know, is truly the way I express who I am. And if it's not expressing who I am, I'm just going to be punishing myself. It's my own hell. And so, she cursed the moon, lost her inner orbit. Her contentment with her lot began to dream of glorifying foreign kings. Now, Rav Kook is also here hinting to another midrash that says that the moon sinned. The moon sinned? What was the sin of the moon? It wanted to be like the sun. So God said, you want to be like the sun? Go make yourself small. You know? Now, what is this midrash? I want to be like the sun. That's the greatest problem. We always want to be who we're not. You know? And we look at others, why can't I be them? You're not them. And if you were to be them, you'd be miserable being them. Right? You've got to learn to be who you are. Very hard. Because we're always, and this Rav Kook talks in other places about the punishment, the self-affliction of jealousy. Why would I be jealous of somebody else? Right? They're not me, I'm not them. Why do I want that? The only time you're jealous of somebody else is when you're not being who you are. When you're being who you are, you won't even think of wanting to be them. But when you're not fulfilled and haven't found that outlet, that unique self-expression of being who you are, that's when you start looking at other people. And the truth is, what you're really jealous of is the fact that they're being who they are. And you make the mistake to think that that's what you want, but that's not what you want, to be who you are. But what is it about them that's bothering you, right, is that they're successfully being who they are, and you want to do that too. And so Rav Kook has given us a beautiful definition, a very painful definition, of what really a sin is in Judaism, and what really a mitzvah is. A mitzvah isn't just a bunch of good points that we do and we add them up, we collect them, and then in the next world we cash them in and we get this big prize in the sky. You know? I know when we're children, that's kind of the way we're taught. You know? When children are growing up, we have a mitzvah chart, we tell them if you do 5 mitzvot, you know, you're gonna get this. My kids come home, they have all these incredible prizes they get from their rebbes because they have certain points and they get this. That's very nice, but at a certain point in education, that becomes counterproductive. Because the child has to learn that the reward of the mitzvah is the mitzvah. The reward of being who you are is being who you are. The reward of being a living expression of divinity is living expression of divinity. There's nothing greater than that. I don't need a next world, because the next world comes to me in this world. Right? It's Olam Haba, the world to come. It'll come to me in this world if I just be who I am. Torah claims, this is his claim, that mitzvot is emunah. It is self-portrayal. And aveira, chet, avon, sin, is self-betrayal. I'm not really being who I am.
And so let's look at this last verse, or this last sentence in this paragraph. And thus the world sinks ever deeper in loss of self, of each and every individual and of the whole. This, Rav Kook wrote this in the early 1900s. It couldn't be any more appropriate than today. This is, I think, one of the greatest problems of our generation. A tremendous loss of self. People don't know who they are. Maybe that's why they call it the X generation. People don't know who they are anymore. They just don't know who they are. And they so much want to know who they are. But they don't know who they are. You know? And I've met people who are so successful, and I thought, well, they would know who they'd be. They don't know who they are. I mean, I'm shocked. You know? And yet, that's why, like someone said the other day, at her Shabbos table, whenever at the table, her husband knows a little bit about the meaning of birthdays in the Hebrew months. She says, every time the table just wakes up when he talks about this stuff. People are so fascinated. Tell me who I am. You think, well, you don't need to tell. How could you tell me who I am? Because you know the name of the month. You're going to tell me. People are so starving. So starving to know who they are. That anybody who tells them, it's terrific. You know, there's this group called Scientology. You probably heard of them. So one of the things they do is they go out on the street and they do free personality tests. Come in, have a free personality test, right? So a friend of mine who knows what this is all about, so he wanted to have a little fun. So he goes out there and guy says, would you like a free personality test? He says, I'd love that. So he sits down. The guy has him fill something out. He comes back. He says to him, you have a tendency to sometimes be depressed. Like, now, that's really easy, you know? So my friend said, me? I'm not depressed. I'm never depressed. Oh, no? Oh. Well, you have a tendency to somehow be hard on yourself. Me? I'm never hard on myself. He drove this guy nuts. But he could see by the whole test that it's so ambiguous. People are so thirsting. Tell me who I am. Tell me what I should do. Tell me what's the right path. I don't know if I shared with you or maybe the program before, but I had a friend. I had some strange friends. Okay, but anyways, one fellow, this is before he did tshuva. He was looking for a job. Opens up the New York Times and looking through, and there's actually an ad for a crystal ball reader and a tea reader, right? So he said, and it says underneath it, no experience necessary. So he says, well, this is terrific, you know? I'll apply. So he goes in there, and the guy, you know, he says, well, so what's your name? He says, you can call me Swami Mami Moishi. You know, he says, okay, fine. So he gives him this crystal ball. He gives him this thing to wear on his head, right? He says, okay, read the ball for me. So he says, okay, this is what I see is happening in your life. You are going through changes. You are going through challenges. And he did this whole shtick. The guy says, I like it. I like it. Terrific, terrific. More, give me more, give me more. So he says, well, he's a good artist. He says, you're hired. You're hired. So he got this job within, you know, one interview to be a crystal ball reader and a tea reader. Okay. So he starts having clients. He's doing terrific. People are coming back. It's just going really well. Well, at a certain point, you know, the neshama can't take it. He feels like, boy, I'm such a con artist. And he finally just couldn't answer his conscience anymore. He walks in and he quits. He says, I can't do this. The guy says, you're the best reader I've had. He says, I can't do this anymore. It's such a rip. I can't do this. So he leaves. Anyways, that day this woman comes in. She said, I'm looking for Swami Wami Moishi. So he says, well, I'm sorry, he quit. He quit? How could he quit? I'm in the middle of a reading. My whole life is dependent on this man. Where is he? Lady, I'm sorry, I cannot give you his address. He quit. Right? He can't quit. So she starts researching to try and find this guy. Well, about 2 weeks later, someone knocks on my friend's door. He opens up and, oh my gosh, it's this client. Oh, I found you. I finally found you. Oh, listen, I'm in the middle of a very important decision. I need your help. He said, listen, lady, I want to pay you back. I'm very sorry, But I'm a fake. You're not a fake. I am a fake. You're not a fake. You're a tea reader, and you're the best crystal ball reader ever met. And he could not convince her that this was all a hoax. Right? People are dying. No. Who am I? What's going on in my life? How can I do it better? What choices should I make? This is such a loss of self. Such an incredible loss of self. You know, every couple blocks, you see these hands in front of, you know, these stores, you know, they read your palms, they read your foreheads, they read your nose, they read your toenails, they read anything, right? But we got to learn to read ourselves. This is our generation, a tremendous loss of self.
All right, come on.
Look, I'll tell you what to me what a Rebbe is, right? To me, you know, a friend of mine was very close to a particular Rebbe. And he said to his Rebbe that, you know, he was going to Chicago. His Rebbe's in Jerusalem. He's going to Chicago. So his Rebbe said to him, he said, hey, Pinchas, you know, you're going to be Chicago. You're looking to get married. You might meet a woman. Pinchas, what are you going to do? You meet a really, you know, tremendous woman, but I won't be there for you to ask my opinion. So Pinchas turned to him and says, Rebbe, I love you very much, and you know I honor you the highest, but I really believe that I'll be able to make that choice on my own. And his Rebbe looked at him with a big smile and says, that's what I wanted to hear, Pinchas. To me, that's a Rebbe. A Rebbe should empower us. Now, I don't want to in any way suggest that Rebbes cannot give us insight. There's nothing wrong with asking people's advice, you know? But on the other hand, you know, it's like there's asking people's advice and then there's running away from yourself. And I think it's a fine line sometimes.
Do you consider that these people are not
saying how to work? I can't. Who are these people? It's so general. I can't make a general statement. You know, some people are just running away from themselves, and they're hoping that someone's going to take their lives and put it all together and tell them, this is what you should be doing, this is who you are, and this is the right way to go. You know, what I find is so incredible about Judaism, and why Judaism could not really turn into a cult if it's really taught properly, is because we are taught to ask questions. And that the greatest joy is when people ask questions. And we love questions, but not right now, I'm going on. Okay, so no questions. Okay, let's just go do this next paragraph. Learned educators come along, caught up with externality. They too are distracted from the self and add fuel to the fire, offering vinegar to the thirsty, cramming minds and hearts with everything other, everything outside of themselves. And the self is gradually forgotten. Because if I am not, neither is he, and moreover, neither are you or thou. Very painful. You see, the goal of education, this is the way we started, is self-discovery. The goal of education is to help a person find themselves, to help a person find that lifestyle which expresses their true inner self. But what happens? You get these, so to speak, learned educators. And they come along and they're caught up with externalities. They don't care about yourself. They care about the way you look, right? How they can add to your externalities. And to me, I experienced this, unfortunately, a number of times when I was learning in Israel. And in one particular yeshiva, I remember it was just before Rosh Hashanah. And one of the heads of the yeshiva called me up. And, you know, in this yeshiva, where most of the guys were wearing black hats and black coats, I wasn't wearing a black hat and a black coat. And it was just before Rosh Hashanah, and the Rosh Yeshiva, it wasn't Rosh Yeshiva, another a high person in the yeshiva called me over. And he said, David, it's tshuva time, it's time to repent. I said, I know. He says, David, you know, Rosh Hashanah's coming, and you know, we really all have to look at ourselves, and we have to make serious decisions, and you know, you really have to consider very seriously. I'm thinking, he's going to give me something. He sees something in me and he's going to, you know. I say, yes, I'm open. Tell me, what is it? What should I do? He says, David, buy a black hat. I was in absolute shock. I was so hurt that's what I have to do. That's what I have to do now. And I thought, well, maybe that's what I don't know. But I felt this was all externity. Externalities. Again, I'm not saying that wearing a black hat is not important, is important. I think everybody has to make that decision for themselves. You know, I remember one fellow went to a rabbi, a great halakhic authority, and he went to the rabbi and says, according to Jewish law, do I have to wear a hat? So he said, yes. He went back. He told his roommate, who wasn't wearing a hat, he says, I was just by the great rabbi so-and-so, and he said that halachically I have to wear a hat. He said, really? I find that hard to believe. So he himself went over to the rabbi and says, do I have to wear a hat? The rabbi said, no, you don't. There is no halacha that you have to wear a hat. So he goes back and says, I don't know what you're talking about, because the rabbi said, you don't have to wear a hat. So the other first guy goes up to the rabbi and says, wait a second, rabbi, I came to you just yesterday. You said, I have to wear a hat. He says, you came yesterday wearing a hat. And if you wear a hat when you see me, you should wear a hat when you see God. But your friend came to me without wearing a hat, so for him it's not a sign of honor. So, externalities. Externalities. Sometimes people in education are more concerned with seeing people put on tzitzis, put on kippahs, you know. And I'm not saying that wouldn't be wonderful to see, but not if their heart's not ready. Because by doing that, you could stifle their process in the worst way. A friend of mine who converted to Judaism, he immediately put on a black hat and a black coat. Again, I'm not diminishing, I don't think that's an unimportant thing to do. I think everyone has to make that decision for themselves. But he decided that. You know, he told me about 3 years later that it was a great mistake. Because he said, I looked so religious that I couldn't ask questions anymore. When I was at the Shabbos table, I was so embarrassed. People say, you know, lead the benching. I couldn't lead the benching. You know, and so I kind of hide from the whole thing. And then there would be discussion at the table and there'd be questions that I'm having, but I feel so uncomfortable. How can I ask this question when I'm such a religious Jew? But he really was only involved for like a number of months. Person has to be so, so careful. So careful. And so, there's a loss of self. And if educators are not concerned with the neshama, with the soul, and allowing the soul to find itself and express itself, then not only does that soul lose itself, you lose yourself. Because we're all interconnected. So if I'm lost myself, then that already in a domino effect affects everybody else, and that affects everybody else, and the whole world sinks into loss of self and loss of self. So Rav Kook brings in an incredible verse, the breath of our nostrils, the anointed of God. This verse in Eicha says that the breath of our nostrils is the Mashiach of God. So what is he talking about? What is the Mashiach of God? The Mashiach of God is when I express myself. That's what Mashiach will do. Mashiach will liberate us from falsities, from being a fake. And we will finally be who we really are. And therefore, every time a person expresses themselves, there's something, there's a certain messianic spark in that. That valor and might is not external to us. It is our own breath. The Lord our God and David our King, whom we shall seek. We stand in awe before the Lord and before His goodness. We shall seek our I, ourselves, and we shall find us. Who is our ultimate I? Hashem is our ultimate I. And when we're being ourselves, it means we are being a living expression of Hashem in this world. Cast off alien gods, remove every stranger and mamzer, and know that I am the Lord your God who brings you out from the land of Egypt to be your God. I am the Lord. That's what it means. What is the redemption that we're waiting for? We're waiting for the redemption of ourselves. We're waiting for the redemption that we can be who we are.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.